from NPR News in Washington, D.C. This is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, the latest from Minneapolis, aggressive immigration action on the streets and sidewalks, and protests from outraged Minnesotans. Then Ron Elving on the Week in Politics, the latest from Kyiv, which is enduring heavy bombing, cold, and blackouts. Then a high school class near Denver, where students try to engineer things they discover people need. And later, a school near Paris, where the payoff is failure. Point made with a pie in the face. Or as a student says,
everyone's good at being good. And if you can be good at being bad, then nothing is bad.
Well, first we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, January 17, 2026.
KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with a special edition of the Up North Report. More than 20,000 holes have been drilled into Minnesota's ground. But of course, Matt Carter has a favorite. He slowly strolled backward, neck craned up at the rows of gigantic metal shelves.
The deepest hole in drilled in Minnesota is right here.
Really?
Yeah, it's the Hattenberger hole.
The drilling was done on the Hattenberger farm near Kettle River. Ever since the Hattenbergers drilled a new well, they'd dealt with air in their plumbing. In 1976, during a power outage, they lit a candle in the bathroom. The ensuing minor explosion revealed the air was in fact flammable gas.
Got private funding to drill, to core the hole. Not just drill, to core 7,700 feet.
Because he was looking for
because
natural gas.
They thought they were going to strike black gold, oil.
Despite their massive investment, they were unsuccessful. Core drilling means using a hollow drill bit to remove a cylinder of rock or other material from a hole. The Department of Natural Resources estimates today it costs about $150 per foot. That expense is one part of the reason the DNR's drill core library in Hibbing is so valuable. Carter is a mineral potential supervisor with the DNR. Based on the cost of drilling alone, he estimates the library is worth $500 million. But of course, there's other ways to evaluate worth. A new mineral, hibbingite, was discovered in the archive. There's evidence of a 1.85 billion-year-old meteorite impact. And the core helps answer geological research questions, including ones we never knew we'd be asking. Not every core's story is as interesting as Hattenberger, but together, they help tell the story of Minnesota's geology, past, present, and future. Two-thirds of states have core collections, and the U.S. Geological Survey has several of its own as well.
This is one of the largest in terms of collections, largest collections in North America, probably top five. We have over 3 million, probably closer to 3.5 million linear feet of core here.
That's enough to stretch from International Falls to Chicago. Minnesota's mining history is a significant driver behind all this drilling. The vast majority of the core comes from mineral exploration. Minnesota is so attractive because of its geology. The Duluth Complex, the formation that spans the Arrowhead, has gotten a lot of attention the last couple years as companies look for critical minerals like copper and nickel, and more recently, gases like helium.
So the geological wonder that is locked in these rocks are wonderful.
Joyashish Takurta is a senior research geologist at the University of Minnesota's Natural Resources Research Institute.
This is a place where you get access to rocks that are in the subsurface, many hundreds of feet or meters down in the interior of the earth, where you can by no means go and collect the rocks from. So that's why this collection is so valuable. You get access to the rocks where they actually are.
Takurta and his colleagues visit the library 5 or 6 times a year, depending on what projects they're working on. Right now, they're looking at manganese on the Cuyuna Range. While recent news has swirled around a potential mine near Emily, companies and geologists have known for years there was manganese in the area. A century ago, some 600 people lived nearby in the now-abandoned Manganese, Minnesota, touted as the Hibbing of the Cuyuna Range. Interest in the mineral has grown with the clean energy push, yet we still don't even know why it's here. That's what Takurta's research aims to answer, using over 200 samples from the Drill Core Library. While there has been exploratory drilling in recent years, the Cuyuna Range hasn't been mined in 4 decades. And there's land that doesn't exist anymore, dug up with the iron.
The record of these layers and manganese enriched or not have been preserved by the companies donated to this repository, and we can go and still access them whenever we want. So it's a preservation of a natural record.
There's a lot that goes into managing this massive physical database. You can learn more about that by reading the full story at kaxe.org. That's it for this special edition of the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. Tensions remain high in Minneapolis. Neighbors are patrolling their streets for immigration enforcement activity as hundreds more federal agents have arrived there in recent days. And now the U.S. Department of Justice has opened a criminal investigation into Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf is in Minneapolis. Kat, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, good morning.
What's it like there?
Well, it was relatively quiet here last night. It's really cold. It's in the single digits and it's been snowing, so it's possible folks are hunkered down inside. But people are still really on edge. Just to give you a sense, Scott, driving around, you'll see people standing on the corners and neighborhoods wearing whistles, ready to blow them and alert their neighbors if ICE shows up. There's a lot of skepticism around unfamiliar cars in the areas, especially ones with out-of-state license plates. And many restaurants, if they're open, are keeping their doors locked, letting customers in as they come, but keeping federal agents out. It's just a pretty tense environment.
And all this occurs as federal immigration officers continue to arrive and make arrests, yes?
Yeah, exactly. There are some 2,500 federal immigration officers on the ground and more expected soon, according to DHS. That's more than four times the number of local Minneapolis police officers. And protests against that surge and the arrests are still happening, too, many of which have been met with aggression. We've seen ICE officers using tear gas, flashbangs, pepper balls to disperse crowds. But late last night, a federal judge here issued a preliminary injunction restricting federal agents from retaliating against people, quote, engaging in peaceful and unobstructive protest activity.
And President Trump has at least been talking about invoking the Insurrection Act.
Yeah.
Which has happened some 30 times in U.S. history. Any indications this would be the latest?
Well, it's really hard to say. The Insurrection Act is a 200-year-old law that, if invoked, would allow Trump to deploy the military to Minneapolis for law enforcement purposes, essentially. Many legal experts I've talked to in the past few days have told me that the situation here in Minneapolis right now just doesn't meet the criteria to justify that. Here's Joseph Nunn. He's an attorney at the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program.
I think if he does, it would be a flagrant abuse of the Insurrection Act, unlike anything that's ever happened before in the history of the country.
And yesterday, Trump walked back his threat earlier this week to do so, but also made it clear he's not taking it off the table.
If I needed it, I'd use it. I don't think there's any reason right now to use it, but if I needed it, I'd use it.
Trump has threatened invoking the Insurrection Act many times in recent months for various situations, so we've heard this kind of talk before. If he did, it would be a highly controversial move and most definitely challenged in court.
And of course, late last night, there was news that the Department of Justice is investigating Mayor Frey and Governor Walz. Of course, both are Democrats. What's the latest? Yeah.
Well, we don't know much about the investigation. It centers on public statements the two made during recent ICE raids here. Fry and Waltz both responded to the news in separate social media posts. Waltz wrote, quote, "Weaponizing the justice system against your opponents is an authoritarian tactic." He urged calm. And one last thing, Scott. There is an anti-immigration march plan later today here, organized by Jake Lang. He's part of the January 6th insurrection on the Capitol, later pardoned by Trump. It's not clear how many people will show up or if there will be counter-protests, but it has many here worried it could be a kind of powder keg moment in the midst of all of this.
NPR's Kat Lonsdorf in Minneapolis. Kat, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We're going to turn now to Ron Elving, a senior contributor, of course, longtime observer of national politics. Ron, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
I want to ask you, a new poll just out about a year into Donald Trump's presidency. It finds that 58% of those polled think his first year of his second term has not been a success. 56% find the fatal shooting of Renee Good an inappropriate use of force. And less than a third say that ICE operations have made America's cities safer. What do you see in these findings?
A lot of warning signs for a second-term president facing a fall that brings midterm elections for Congress. And it's not only CNN. The same message comes from other media polls and academic polls. The Associated Press works with people who compile a great deal of public opinion data. Their latest poll shows some erosion even among Republicans on some issues. Immigration was his best issue all last year. But even that's underwater for him now. Just 38% approve of his handling of immigration since the last ICE raids in that poll. Yet, what is most striking is the disapproval on parts of Trump's foreign policy. It's rare to see any national polling question get a 60% negative response. But the idea of taking Greenland by force is opposed by nearly 70% of Americans.
And given these poll numbers, why do you think almost no change in course from the White House a year in?
There have been some efforts to vary the program, if not really change course. The president has changed tactics on household affordability as an issue, saying it's something to take seriously, proposing means of lowering home prices. In response to other controversies, the president has backed off on some of his threats. He hasn't struck Iran yet. He has not declared a state of emergency in Minnesota, as we just heard from Kat. And he has not yet put tariffs on countries that oppose his takeover of Greenland. But I'm reminded of two three-word phrases that we heard a lot in the first Trump term. One was flood the zone, and the other was audience of one. Flood the zone meant that if there was a bad story in the news, the best way to handle it was to blow it away with a flurry of actions or statements that were sure to grab attention. So, whether the bad story is the Epstein files or the battles over ICE, we are suddenly seeing lots of unexpected stories. We mentioned Greenland and the tariffs, and now the chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Jerome Powell, is being investigated. We mentioned the Minnesota governor and mayor of Minneapolis being investigated, possibly charged with obstructing, but no investigation yet for the ICE agent who shot an unarmed woman 4 times in that city. And as for the audience of one, it's clear that much is said and done in this White House and this administration with just one mind in mind.
What signals do you see about this administration's plans for Iran?
Those plans are not entirely clear at this point, but the president has sent an aircraft carrier battle group to the area and done a lot of saber rattling, not unlike what he did before the incursion into Venezuela. Late in the week, the president backed off a bit on this one, too, after Iran withdrew its threatened mass executions of protesters. The death toll is already in the thousands there. But both the mullahs in Tehran and the president in Washington seem to have heard from allies and partners in the Arab world and elsewhere, all trying to lower the tension, prevent a U.S. strike, and one argument being that such a strike would worsen the situation without solving it. And those entreaties may have been heard and heeded, at least for the moment.
Finally this week, Ron, what are your thoughts on the Nobel Peace Prize that President Trump seemed to acquire this week?
The Nobel Committee made it clear the prize was still Mujado's to keep but not to give away. She did give the president the medal that went with the prize. That was surely a measure of how much she wanted to please and placate the president, and a measure of her willingness to sacrifice for her cause, and we might add, a measure of her savvy in dealing with a certain audience of one.
NPR's Ron Elving, as always, a pleasure to talk to you, my friend. Talk to you later. Take care.
Thank you, Scott.
The death of a possible genius was reported this week. I, a chimpanzee who was born in West Africa and came to the Primate Research Institute of Kyoto University in Japan when she was a year old, has died of natural causes at the age of 49. They say she was surrounded by the staff who have known her. Ai, by the way, means love in Japanese, and she was remarkable. She was the first chimpanzee to successfully label numbers. Tetsuro Matsuzawa, one of the researchers, wrote in 2021 for the International Journal Inference. That was when she was five. At 6 and a half, she began learning the alphabet, and soon, Matsuzawa wrote, was able to discriminate between all 26 uppercase letters. At the age of 7 and a half, I had learned the lexigrams. Those are three-letter symbols for apple, banana, carrot, cabbage, and more. She could eventually identify more than 100 Japanese kanji characters and 11 different colors. As was always said, when I was shown an apple in one study, she chose a rectangle, a square, and a dot on a computer screen to draw an apple virtually. I reportedly liked to draw and paint in her off time. One of her creations was printed on a scarf and given to the late primatologist Dame Jane Goodall. In 1989, I slipped out of her cage and picked up a key to open the cages of Akira, another research chimp, Dudu, an orangutan. An escapade, by the way, with all the makings of a primate heist film. Eyes 3. It's always hazardous to try to put yourself into someone else's skin, human or primate, but I like to think that Ai's restless intelligence made her curious about the world beyond the confines of her research institute. The ape escape didn't last long, though. A couple of grad students called Dr. Matsuzawa to report that Ai was strolling around campus with the key in her mouth. Did you think chimps would carry Birkin bags? When I encountered the student, she reportedly showed them her backside. This is considered a signal of deference among primates, if not humans, and I and her companions were returned to the lab. I leaves a 25-year-old son, a Yuma, who is reportedly also powerfully intelligent. Human scientists will continue to learn from him and he from them, like mother, like son. You're listening to NPR News.
In today's world of on-demand media streaming over the internet, one has to wonder, why does traditional radio still matter? I'm Steve Noy, IT and broadcast engineer for KAXE. Why do we work so hard to offer traditional broadcasting when people can just jump on the internet and get instant access? Well, here's why. KAXE is available to everyone in our listening area, no matter your financial or social status. Anyone with a radio can hear KAXE, and you get the same great experience whether you're a member, a business sponsor, or just hearing about us for the first time. We do stream on our website, but it doesn't take a costly internet connection to hear KAXE. That's why we're looking for your help. We serve the whole community, and we can't do that without you. Tell others about us, or text the word donate to 218-326-1234. KAXE is an equalizer, making great content available to you no matter who you are. KAXE is people-powered radio.
It is 7:19. Thanks for listening to KAXE and Weekend Edition. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Grand Rapids State Bank, committed to serving the Grand Rapids area for over 110 years. More at grsb.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Mostly cloudy to partly sunny today, highs 0 to 7, northwest winds up to 25 miles per hour, lows tonight 7 to 11 below 0, and tomorrow snow possible before noon, 1/2 inch to 2 inches expected, highs 6 to 13, lows tomorrow night 10 to 15 below 0, and for Monday, mostly cloudy, cold once again, highs 4 below to 1 above. Friends of the Brainerd Public Library have their annual meeting this Wednesday, 5 to 7 at the library. Learn about the work they did last year and how you can get involved. A light meal will be served. There's more ahead from Weekend Edition here on KAXE.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Ukrainians are weathering their toughest winter since Russia's full-scale invasion nearly 4 years ago. Repeated Russian attacks have badly damaged the Ukrainian energy grid, and that has left cities, including Kyiv, the capital, without heating and electricity for long periods of time in the freezing snow and ice. NPR's Joanna Kakissis joins us from Kyiv. Joanna, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on the show, Scott.
How cold is it? How are you and everyone else managing?
It's cold. The sun is shining today, and that does make things a little better, but it's still 13 degrees Fahrenheit out. We're lucky at the Bureau because we have this backup battery for electricity. However, the heating is out for long periods, so it's really cold in our house, and I am wearing my coat right now. And outside, businesses are using generators to keep operating. But many homes are cold and dark. It's so cold indoors in some homes that windows are icing up. People can see their breath, and children are vulnerable. We met one mom, Inessa Rojdesvinska. She was inside a bus that had been turned into a mobile shelter. It's a place where people can keep warm. They can warm up. They can charge their phones. She sipped hot tea as her two daughters, who are 5 and 2, were eating steaming bowls of instant ramen. She says she goes to cafes to fill up thermoses with hot water, which she then pours into hot water bottles at home to help warm the beds at night.
Joanna, any sense of how long these power outages might last?
Well, Scott, you know, Ukrainian energy workers are remarkably efficient at getting power plants and substations operating quickly again, even after repeated attacks. But it's a Sisyphean task. They rebuild them, and then there are more strikes. Also, Kyiv is filled with these enormous apartment buildings. They're like 25, 30 stories high. They're heated through a system that pumps hot water through pipes. And because Russian attacks have damaged the system during sub-zero temperatures, the water is frozen in some of these pipes and burst them. So these will have to be fixed, too. I spoke with Ukrainian energy expert Oleksandr Harchenko, who said only about a quarter of the electricity needed is available to Kyiv right now. And he said he believes the Russian attacks aim to make Kyiv and other cities unlivable.
It's absolutely clear. Target was to kill the city. Target was to freeze the city and to push 3 million or 4 million, I don't know exactly how many people live right now in Kyiv, but to push them out of the city.
And he says the Kremlin wants to wear down Ukrainians so they will give up and make more concessions to Russia.
Do you see signs of fatigue among the citizens?
Trying to live a normal life when you're freezing is exhausting. Inessa Rojdesvenska, the mother we met in the mobile shelter, she said that before the war, you know, when the heat wasn't disrupted like this, she used to love seeing Kyiv blanketed in snow and icicles. But now she says she will probably move to Western Ukraine if this blackout situation here in Kyiv lasts much longer. Other Ukrainians we spoke to say they will stay in Kyiv no matter what. One is personal trainer and former professional volleyball player, Polina Lutakova.
It came to my mind the words of my mom. My mom, she said to me, like, we are survivors, and let's say it's a test for us. We have to survive no matter how, and we will.
And Scott, this is a sentiment I've heard over and over again. It shows up in public opinion surveys as well. Ukrainians want peace, and they are pressing their leaders for an end to the war, but not on Russia's terms.
NPR's Joanna Kakissis in Kyiv, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
This first year of the second Trump administration has been especially tough for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The agency is supposed to investigate fraud, but instead it's mostly been dealing with work stoppages, layoffs, and funding threats. NPR's Stephen Bisaha reports on the year-long attempt to dismantle the government watchdog.
The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is probably best known for going after banking giants, like accusing Wells Fargo of doing things like illegally seizing homes and cars and fining the bank billions of dollars. But really, the agency's watchdog duties cover a lot more.
Everybody that affects your wallet and your bank account.
Lisa Rosenthal's 12-year career as an investigator and manager at the CFPB gives a sense of that scope.
I focused on payday loan victims.
The auto finance market.
The federal student loan market.
And debt collectors. And since it's been created, the CFPB's returned nearly $20 billion to consumers. So it sounds like you take a lot of pride in the work you did.
I take a lot of pride in the work that we did as a, you know, as an institution.
Congress created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in 2010 after the 2008 financial crisis. Basically, it took the consumer protection duties of other agencies and put them under one roof, along with new supervising and rulemaking powers. But throughout the past year, the Trump administration has tried to dismantle the agency through layoffs and cutting off funds. To do that, Trump made one of the CFPB's biggest critics the agency's acting director, Russell Vogt.
All they want to do is weaponize the tools of financial laws against basically small mom and pop lenders and other small financial institutions.
That was Vogt on the Charlie Kirk Show last fall, criticizing some of the agency's staff. We reached out for comment from Vogt's office and the CFPB and have not heard back. One of Vogt's first actions was emailing workers and telling them to stop working. Bank examinations have been paused, cases were dismissed, regulations withdrawn. All while over the past year, the number of complaints against companies sent to the CFPB to investigate have nearly doubled. Lisa Rosenthal made a decision.
This work that I had carried out for these decades and that I cared so deeply about, this was no longer that work.
She resigned in February. As for the workers who tried to stay, in April, 84% of them got layoff notices.
Everyone was upset.
Helen Shaw was one of them.
Colleagues were crying. It was very worrisome.
Shaw regulates interstate land sales, basically making sure property developers are telling the truth to potential buyers. Now, a district court judge has blocked those layoffs while the legal fight continues. And Shaw says she will not be forced out.
I'm determined to stay because I really believe in the mission of helping individual consumers.
The CFPB gets funded from the Federal Reserve, so Vogt's recent plan to stop the agency was to refuse to ask for those funds. But in December, that same district judge ordered Vogt to make the request, and he did. The judge also wrote in her decision the agency is, quote, hanging by a thread. Some work like Shaw's has resumed, but she says bank inspections have essentially been paused, and the threats to the agency's future have not gone away.
We're still at risk of losing our existence, I think.
Even some critics that were never in favor of the CFPB don't like how the Trump administration's doing this.
Well, I'm conflicted.
Norbert Michel runs the Cato Institute's Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives, and yeah, he thinks the CFPB should not exist, that it's redundant. But he also thinks Congress, not the administration, should be the one dismantling the CFPB. And he's concerned there isn't any legislation instructing other agencies to fill in the consumer protection gap.
Now you have a lot of those things that are not being done. So that gets me a little bit nervous.
He does say there are still state and local agencies enforcing consumer protection laws. But Helen Shaw says weakening the CFPB goes against one of President Trump's priorities.
We're the agency to help consumers with the affordability crisis.
One of Trump's affordability proposals is capping credit card interest rates. Shaw says enforcing that would naturally be the CFPB's job.
It's confusing, right? Because they're stating that they'll pursue ways to alleviate the affordability crisis for families, yet we're not fully functional right now.
And those early court actions that protected the CFPB from things like layoffs, those were just temporary. The legal battle that could decide the fate of the agency is likely to be long and drawn out, a battle Shaw calls existential. Stephen Bisaha, NPR News.
One powerful way to engage students is to have them build real-world products that help other people. Students in a technology class at a high school in suburban Denver are doing just that. It is called Empathy Engineering. And Colorado Public Radio's Jenny Brundin paid a visit.
What you're about to hear from 17-year-old Bia Ingalls is music to a teacher's ears.
This is the coolest project I've ever worked on.
The project is redesigning the classic board game Codebreakers. The reason it's so cool? Ingalls says it's a real request from a client, a nonprofit that makes learning products for people who are blind and low vision.
It's like I get to work on something that is going to positively impact someone who needs it. Like, this isn't a fun project because my mom wanted a table. It's a, these kids can't have access to these resources because if any other company made this, it'd be $100.
Students are now waiting for feedback on the 10 prototypes they submitted to American Printing House. It's distributing them to schools of the blind nationwide for testing. Students will refine the design before a local manufacturer takes over.
It's on you now. So this is how it is in the real world. You're dumping in, you got to get a product out the door, divide and conquer. I'm here for you.
Teacher Brian Jernigan kicks off the class, and the juniors jump in. Today, they're building the prototype.
So picture this whole top circular area, and then just imagine if that was the shape on the top.
Okay. Would you also like to keep the circular bit at the bottom?
Jernigan became sold on injecting empathy into student projects years ago. The University of Colorado approached him with a federal grant to explore 3D printing to help visually impaired children read. The shift in his high school student designers was immediate.
All of a sudden, 100% of the kids giving me 100% of what they had, they all really tried because they're like, oh, my time matters. And that was the magic moment that I saw.
Fast forward more than a decade.
You have lasers, you have fine woodworking equipment, you've got 3D scanners, you have high-end computers that work.
Jernigan secured another grant to transform the old workshop into a modern-day design lab. But hey, these kids have a deadline.
Yeah. All the original measurements and what our final measurements.
Let's get back to it. For those who don't know the game Codebreakers, someone guesses the order of a row of colored pegs. Student Andrew Hania explains for visually impaired children, color won't work.
So our biggest focus is just making everything tactile.
They're scaling up peg sizes, adding ridges, numbering rows. For a newcomer, the lab looks like controlled chaos. Everyone works on a piece of the puzzle. Massimo Ayes has an idea.
Bit and having triangle on this one since it has jagged edges.
You do have five pegs. The other problem is I think you're overestimating how complicated I can make those.
They compromise.
I agree with just doing it off of texture, like a cone or like a circle.
When something doesn't work, students pivot fast.
The way I designed it would actually not work incredibly well. It'd be really hard to identify to someone else.
American Printing House is excited the project is helping train future designers to build accessibility into their work.
So these kids, what they're getting is an opportunity to put something on their resume that's real, relevant, and will be for the rest of their lives.
But Codebreakers isn't the only accessible project students are working on. Still others are designing personal innovations.
So I'm designing a wooden satellite that will burn up on reentry to the atmosphere.
It's an arm brace to ensure your arms can retain and or regain stability.
It's a clip that shortens the bottom of pants without having to hem them.
I'm trying to design a toy where the packaging is built in and isn't thrown away.
I'm making a climate conditions monitoring system to track conditions in pika habitats. And it's going to be like self-powered and it has like camouflaged as a rock.
Here at the school, a speech therapist asked for a teaching aid for speech device users. Neo Crooks designed 96 color-coded core word blocks.
This is a product that definitely could turn into money. I don't care about that. The fact that it's going to make an impact for what could be nationwide, that's such a great thing. And that's just something you get to carry with you.
Jernigan says after teaching kids the basic skills, he steps back.
It's not easy. It's not clear. It's not black and white. It's not, hey, how do I get an A on the test? It's dirty. It's messy. It takes time. There's failures. There's setbacks. And, you know, that's life. That's life, right? And then we pile a little bit of empathy on it, and it just, you know, it fuels them, and it fuels me.
Before the kids file out, Jernigan asks for a one-word summary of the class.
Learn.
Innovative.
Innovative.
Engaging.
Great.
Great. I love it.
Fun.
Fun.
For NPR News, I'm Jenny Brundin in Littleton, Colorado.
listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. The Chicago Bears and the Green Bay Packers are just about the oldest rivalry in football. The Packers have been pretty dominant in recent years. They've emphasized this by donning cheese-headed foam rubber hats. Well, I guess that counts as stylish in Eau Claire. But this year, the Bears shredded their cheesy rivals, not only in the wild card playoff round, but with their own foam hat, a cheese grater. They're manufactured by Foam Party Hats, a company in Texas owned by Grace and Manuel Rojas, who are a mother and son, who join us now. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Thanks.
How did you come up with this idea for a cheese grater hat?
We have our own rivalry with the Packers.
You mean they're in Houston? Yeah.
Correct. So we receive a cease and desist letter from the Green Bay Packers because we used to make a cheese hat that we used to sell online really well. Because of the attention, the Packers sent us a cease and desist letter. So we had to take it down. We couldn't fight them because the lawyers are going to be too expensive. And that's when my mom and I just came up with the idea of the cheese grater as a rebellion against the Packers.
Oh, my word. Oh, that's wonderful. You're originally from Venezuela, right?
That is correct. So we have been living in the U.S. since 2010.
How'd you get into that? I've never asked this question before. How did you get into the foam rubber hat business?
It all set up. Like, my mom, she's the creative genius behind all of the different products that we do. She has designed more than 800, 900 different hats. The whole idea started back in Venezuela in, I will say, the 2000s, so around 2002 or whatnot. And my mom, she wanted to make something different and something fun for my sister's wedding. She came up with, she bought some foam and then designed the first foam party hats. And then after that, people in Venezuela started buying it directly from her because they were a huge success at the wedding. And then, of course, we moved in 2010 to Houston. And fast forward 2017, we create the foam party hats. And, now with the virality of the cheese grater hats, the business is booming and we're really happy and grateful with everything that's going on.
Yeah. I mean, if I may speak to the designer, it's like talking to Coco Chanel. You are the Coco Chanel of cheese grater hats.
Yes. Every day I made some design. She's
too humble. She...
Yeah, I mean, it's not so good.
Coco Chanel was humble, too. I get a little wispy. You were a great American success story. I mean, you come to the United States, you found your own business, you're a huge success, you're important to people. It's great.
Yes. I started making some hats and I did a website in 2010 and I started selling all the world. I was here in the United States and I sell hats for Australia, Europe, Spain, different places. At the beginning.
Yeah, so that's the reason I decided to jump into the business because I know I was in the house and at some point she told me, I'm making these hats for Australia. And I was like, what do you mean like you're making hats for Australia? So, yeah, and then that's why when we decided to make the hats. But going back to your point, yeah, definitely, we're happy to be here and then, see all the success and the story behind it is being wonderful, to say the least.
Well, I it's been wonderful to talk with both of you. Thanks very much.
Well, Scott, thank you so much. And, well, let's go Bears. Bear down.
Go Bear.
This is NPR News.
It is 7:39. You're listening to KAXE and Weekend Edition. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Barr. Chilly day ahead, mostly cloudy to partly sunny, high 0 to 7, northwest winds 10 to 25 miles per hour. Lows tonight 7 to 11 below 0, and tomorrow snow is possible before noon, 1/2 inch to 2 inches expected with highs 6 to 13. And for Monday, mostly cloudy and colder with highs 4 below to 1 above. Happy Dancing Turtle in Pine River has a swap for used puzzles, books, games, and DVDs and CDs today from 9 to noon. You do not need to donate items in order to take items. United Way Bemidji is offering assistance to those affected by last summer's derecho. If you need repairs to your home or need help navigating insurance coverage, you can fill out a form at unitedwaybemidji.org or contact their office. We continue with Weekend Edition here on KAXE. I'm Windsor Johnston with these headlines. The Justice Department is investigating whether Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey obstructed federal immigration enforcement. The probe focuses on public statements made during recent ICE raids. A senior Iranian cleric is calling for the death penalty for people arrested in anti-government protests. Demonstrations began last month over Iran's economy. Human rights groups say more than 3,000 protesters have been killed. Tens of thousands of demonstrators gathered in Havana on Friday to protest the killing of 32 Cuban officers in Venezuela. They're also demanding the release of former President Nicolas Maduro, who was arrested by the U.S. this month. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson were both heroes. Robinson, the great athlete who broke baseball's color barrier and inspired millions across America with his courage under a hail of hatred. As Count Basie's band sang,
"Hit the street, Jackie Robinson, hit that ball. It went zooming across the left field wall. Yeah, boy."
And Paul Robeson, who had been a college football star, then played in the NFL while he went to Columbia Law School and would become one of the most admired bass baritone singers in the world.
Old Man River, that old man River, he must know something.
Both men were mighty advocates for equal rights. Though they never met, they were brought into public disagreement during the period of McCarthyism and what became known as the Red Scare. Howard Bryant, who talks about sports on our show, has a new book, Kings and Pawns, Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson in America. And Howard joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me, Scott.
Howard, please set the scene for us. July 1949. Why was Jackie Robinson asked to appear before the House Un-American Activities Committee?
It was a time when the Cold War was beginning to ramp up to a point where, for the next 40 years, where the United States and the Soviet Union were mortal enemies. The great Robeson had given a speech saying that he thought it was unthinkable that the African-American community would fight on behalf of the United States, or something to that effect, when the Soviet Union had lifted up non-white people to a state of humanity or a place of humanity. Now, he had never said those words. He had been quoted by the Associated Press. And the response, of course, was extremely vocal against. And the response was to find an African-American to counter Robeson's speech. I have to remember that Paul Robeson was one of the most famous, if not the most famous, black American in the world at that time. And the House Un-American Activities Committee went to Jackie Robinson, who at that time was also the most famous black person in America, to testify against Robeson.
I haven't any comment to make except that, on that statement, except that if Mr. Robeson actually made it, it sounds very silly to me. But he has a right to his personal views, and if he wants to sound silly when he expresses them in public, that's his business and not mine.
Howard, what was the effect?
The effect was extremely damaging to Robeson. His personal status had been declining anyway, but Jackie's testimony really did turn the rest of the country against Robeson, whatever was left of Robeson's reputation.
I know I feel compelled to point out, I mean, of course, Jackie Robinson, who had served in the U.S. Army, was also briefly court-martialed for refusing to move to the back of a bus on an Army base in Texas. I mean, he was not a pushover for anyone.
No, and that's the hard thing about this. I think what I was trying to get at in this project was you have these two gigantic figures, and both of them were in this position of advocacy for their people. And the most compelling thing I found here was the lengths that both of them felt like they had to go, only to end up really disillusioned by the time they reached the end of their lives, because neither one sort of felt as though they accomplished that goal.
I have to ask, in these times, why didn't Paul Robeson denounce the rule of Joseph Stalin, especially after the Soviet Union itself exposed some of the cruelties of Stalin's regime?
I think part of it is pride, the pride of being a ball player, of being that Robeson believed that the United States had blood on its hands as well. And he said so in his own testimony to HUAC in 1956, where you've killed 60 million of my people, and I'm not going to discuss this with you. And I don't think, I think he felt like there was no, that the motivation of the committee was simply to get him to admit he was wrong about Russia, when what he wanted was for the United States to admit that it had been wrong in what it had done to African Americans. And also out of pain. I think that the Robeson piece of this was very, very painful too, because he believed in the Soviet experiment like a lot of people did. And I think that in a lot of ways, it was sort of like a man without a country, that he had believed in this new experiment in Russia, just as he had once believed in the experiment in the United States. And both, I think, had sort of betrayed his ideals.
You're right today that the U.S. might be going through a period of retrenchment, similar to what you saw in the what we saw in the years of the Red Scare.
Well, that's right. Well, so much of the playbook today feels like the second Red Scare. You have the attack on left-wing and progressive politics. You have the attack on the arts and the defunding of the arts. The vitriol, the sort of the language that we hear today is very similar to the language that we were hearing then. And it was fascinating to me how the parallels feel even more and more urgent. You know, what is past is prologue.
Two great men, Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson, had tough later years, didn't they?
They did. And I think that I felt such compassion in a lot of ways for both of them, for these two great men. Robeson lost everything and had been forgotten in a lot of ways. And there was, you know, and that has translated into today as well. I mean, he is, when I talk to young black kids about Paul Robeson, when I talk to black people about Paul Robeson my age, they don't know who he is. And when I think about Jackie, it's somewhat similar, even though, of course, he remains an icon and people know the name Jackie Robinson. But what they don't know is that, you know, the disillusionment that he felt. So it's this really sort of bittersweet story, and also inspiring to me, though, of these two people who did everything that the United States had asked of them, and yet both wound up in a very disillusioned place.
Rachel Robinson, bless her, still with us.
103 years old, Scott.
Maybe we should end with how she sees it.
Rachel Robinson is such an important character in this book and in the story of Jackie Robinson. People need to know that when Jackie, for everything that we talk about today, baseball was tired of Jackie Robinson. The sport could not wait to get rid of him. The Dodgers traded him to the hated Giants in 1956 at the end of the season. They were tired of him fighting for civil rights. They were tired of him complaining about the American racial order. If it's not for Rachel Robinson and her charm and her intelligence and her determination to restore Jackie's reputation and her grit, she's the one who brought Jackie back. She's the one who went to the Dodgers. She's the one who went to Major League Baseball and said, "Don't forget this man." And so to me, there's no telling this story of Jackie Robinson and his place in American history right now without Rachel. Rachel is really the one who made it happen.
Howard Bryant, talk to you next week.
Oh, my pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
His new book, Kings and Pawns, Jackie Robinson and Paul Robeson in America.
All right, all right, all right.
He has one of the most recognizable voices in Hollywood. And if you're a little dazed and confused, We're talking about Matthew McConaughey. The actor has now trademarked his pear-like tones and his likeness in an age where many performers fear that artificial intelligence could be used to reproduce their voice and images and even replace them. The Wall Street Journal says McConaughey has had 8 trademark applications approved over the past few months. And the actor said in an email to the newspaper that he wants to, quote, create a clear perimeter around ownership with consent and attribution, the norm in an AI world. Well, we spoke with him 5 years ago, and after we had some trouble connecting, I simply couldn't resist deploying a cheap human trick.
I'm not sure I can hear Mr. McConaughey. In fact, I'm sure I can't hear Mr. McConaughey, so let's ask our...
Hang on, can you hear me now, Mr. Simon?
I can hear you, Mr. McConaughey. Very good to be with you. Wait, could you ask me again if I can hear you?
Can you hear me now, Mr. Simon?
All right, all right, all right!
All right!
All right.
Now we're live.
You clearly are the professional who can do it much better than I can.
McConaughey's attorneys say they aren't yet aware of AI being used to manipulate his voice or likeness. The actor himself is an investor in 11 Labs, a software company that specializes in AI voice modeling. So it seems Matthew McConaughey is just fine with his voice being used, just as long as it's authorized.
All right, all right, all right.
At a famed clown school near Paris, students are taught how to fail. They pay for it, they're critiqued on it, and sometimes humiliated by it. Reporter Rebecca Rossman got a rare peek inside the classroom where flopping is mandatory, and what matters is what students do next.
Few things are more terrifying than the idea of stepping onto a stage, staring out at a room full of strangers, and hoping, desperately, that you can make them laugh.
6 acts. Should we go into the first?
This is the École Philippe Gaulier, where people have been paying, yes, paying, to risk public embarrassment for more than 40 years. And tonight, I'm the one watching students perform short acts, where the punchline is almost always a pie in the face.
And I just do it.
Everyone is in costume, red noses and all. A giraffe, a mermaid, a man in a sombrero. Their assignment? Be funny. They usually aren't.
Don't hurt me, I'm just a little boy. Give me one of those pies.
People come from all over the world to study here. Doctors, priests, actors. They gather in the small town of Etampes, about an hour south of Paris, where they regularly endure feedback like this.
We were not laughing, we were embarrassed, we are not sure if you are happy to see us.
That's Philippe Gaulier, the school's founder, speaking to students during a workshop the BBC recorded back in 2015. For Gaulier, clowning isn't about technique, it's about play. But he says not everyone is built for this work.
This pleasure to be ridiculous, this pleasure to have a special humor, no, is given to some people, but not everybody.
A stroke 3 years ago forced Gaulier to retire from full-time teaching. But his fingerprints are everywhere here, shaping every exercise, every critique, and every nervous student hoping for a laugh. Just like his predecessor, instructor Carlo Iacucci, doesn't mince words.
I see 2 clowns looking aimlessly in this direction and wasting our time.
Iacucci, a matter-of-fact Franco-Italian who has been teaching here for more than a decade, sits with a drum between his legs. And when it sounds,
thank you.
It's time.
Welcome, everyone, the worst moment of the class. Now we have reached it. It will not be worse than this.
The worst moment, they call it le flop, the part everyone dreads. But it's actually where the real work begins. Student Gabriela Flores is from Brazil.
Okay, should I be angry with who?
With me.
She's standing on the stage in an orange flamenco dress, looking confused. Something about her act just isn't landing. It needs more emotion. Iacucci tells her to get angry.
Coward!
Yes.
I'm pissed off.
Oh, I feel so afraid.
She gets louder. and louder until something breaks loose.
Carlo! Carlo!
Ah! And then she throws a pie at her stage partner.
I'm fed up with... Oh, one sec.
The room laughs with her. Even Yakuchi looks stunned.
Me? I am shocked. I didn't know you could change.
Cathartic moments like this have fueled a new generation of performers who are redefining what it means to clown.
So I just want to get to know this crowd. This is truly one of the most beautiful crowds I've ever seen in my entire life.
Among them, Zach Zucker.
If I may. May I approach?
His alter ego, Jack Tucker, leads Stamptown, a high-energy, raunchy vaudeville variety show with a global following. A decade ago, Zucker was working for Goliath alum Sacha Baron Cohen in Los Angeles when he heard Philippe was in town teaching a workshop.
And 5 minutes in, I saw Philippe work his magic, and I just could not believe what I was watching.
Zucker had trained in American improv schools, Second City and Upright Citizens Brigade among them. But this felt different. Other places teach you how to succeed. Goliath teaches you how to fail.
Everyone's good at being good. And if you can be good at being bad, then nothing is bad. And it's enjoyable, and it's actually more humbling.
Zucker's Stamptown leans into that.
Trying to realize this crowd was lactose intolerant.
And now it's getting noticed. The show will run a special on a major streaming platform this year. But back in Etampes, success feels far away. Clowning here is still raw, still painful. After class, I find student Frank Benson from Melbourne still catching his breath.
It was tough today. It wasn't a good day for me, yeah. It was, I felt like sometimes you go out and it flops really hard and it's not so fun.
But he says he's getting used to it. The disappointment passes faster now. And for some, it opens the door to something new. Here's Gabriella Flores again.
Nothing is a mistake. If you play with it, if you're being honest with the present moment, I think. This is the poetry of this school. Everything is open as poetry and possibilities. Nothing is defined.
Nothing is a mistake if you play with it. That might be Philippe Goliath's legacy, learning how to stand in front of a room, bomb completely, and keep going, even if there's nothing to show for it in the end but a pie in the face. Rebecca Rossman, NPR News, Etampes. France.
Oof. But no clowning around. BJ Lederman does our theme music. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the NPR Wine Club, now shipping to additional states. Whether purchasing a few wines or joining the wine club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It is just before 8 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Find us at KAXE.org or you can ask your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. You can text the word donate to 218-326-12. Thank you so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of Weekend Edition from National Public Radio. We'll also hear the Up North Report, 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week's stories for winter survival, 10 o'clock, Jerry Bredeman, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. A mix of clouds and sun today, high 0 to 7, northwest winds 10 to 25. Our lows tonight, 7 to 11 below 0. And tomorrow, snow is possible in the morning, 1/2 inch to 2 inches expected, high 6 to 13. And lows tomorrow night, 10 to 15 below. And on Monday, mostly cloudy and cold, highs 4 below to 1 above. Receive support from the First State Bank of Big Fork with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912. FSBBigFork.com. Member FDIC.